I'd now invite Malcolm Shrimpton forward to deliver his address, The Bible, History, and You.
About 30 years ago, Josie and I took our first visit to Israel. It was one of those guided tours. You know, you go in a group, you go in a bus, and we had a very nice Jewish lady as our tour guide. This interesting thing about this lady was that she knew her Old Testament very, very well. She knew it inside and out. And yet, when it came to the question of religion, she professed to really have no religion at all. She just accepted the Bible. Well, why? Why would anybody that has no particular religion accept the Bible? Because for the Jewish people, it's their history book. And that she was quite pleased to announce. And that was where how she applied her knowledge. And as a tour guide, she was able to tell us who had been where, when, and what had happened as we went throughout the land. It was a very, very interesting experience. In my teens, we came to Canada in the late 40s, and tomorrow is the May Day parade. The second parade that we saw was in 1949, and the nation of Israel had just been established, and there was a float in that parade commemorating the establishment of the nation of Israel. I remember it particularly because being new to this town, you do the things that are in the town, and we went, of course, to see the parade. And there was a float to commemorate the establishment of the nation of Israel. And we talked a lot about what had gone on in the establishment of that nation at that time, because the Jews had seemingly rediscovered their history when they went back into the land. When they read the books of the Old Testament, particularly the writings of Joshua and Judges, they discovered all sorts of routes that had been taken by Joshua when he went on that campaign throughout the land, for instance. And those same routes came in very handy when the Jews were fighting for their lives against the Arab nations round about. It was their knowledge of their history book which actually gave them the basis for the military planning, which were the guerrilla-style planning that went in to that campaign against the Arab nations in the late 40s. And so, you see, for that people, the Bible and history actually meant something. For them, knowing the history that was in the Bible was a matter of life and death. It was a matter of whether or not they had a homeland or whether they lost their homeland. And their knowledge of the Bible enabled them to successfully take that land for themselves and reestablish themselves in the land. Now, those of us who were going to Sunday school in those days, of course, went through all of the verses in the Old Testament that indicated that the Jews would indeed go back to the land, and lo and behold, we said, here, look, prophecy is being fulfilled. And for those of us then in the Christian era, that was where the history took us. It was history that was going to repeat itself. The Jews were going back to their land, and this was a sign that the coming of Kingdom of God was not too far away when Jesus would return yet again. So the question then is, now that we've started to forget about that, now that we've begun to think more in terms of the suffering of the Palestinians than the reestablishment of the Jews, as nationally, that's certainly what's happening, and now that in the schools we are teaching ever more that the Bible is an unreliable piece of literature, and certainly as far as sociologists are concerned and the people that frame the legal system and the in mental environment in which we live, the Bible really has no place in today's society. For as the ethicists will tell you, the preeminent piece of ethical behavior is one which you develop from your own set of beliefs. Ethics which come to you from a secondary source are considered then subordinate in today's way of thinking. So the Bible no longer has this sort of preeminence in people's minds. It's been replaced by what I would like to do and what I feel is appropriate for me to do now. So what I want to do tonight is to go back through some of the bits of history, as it were, in the Jewish background. Some of the things that we can document very accurately at this, with what we know now. And then ask ourselves the question, well, should we really be discarding the Bible? Is there a basis for for actually accepting it as it sits in front of us? And if we can conclude that then, can we conclude that the Bible should have a place in our lives today? Well, in the mid-1700s, started a school of critical thought which really tore the text of the Bible to pieces, left it in little shreds, and indicated that there were several strands that had been written by many different hands over the years, and then woven together, and some people would say that the Bible has been woven together in the sort of the period between about 200 and 400 BC, and it has been brought to us from ideas which were remembered, from things which had sort of kept in the colloquial memory, and had then were written down and brought together at that point in time. And this way of thinking has been one of the most forceful matters that people have used to dispense with much of the authenticity of the Bible. It's considered then to be a set of myths which certainly have social value, but which have very little basis in fact. Well, in the late 1840s, a gentleman called Henry Layard made a series of lightning strikes on a number of tells throughout the Middle East, throughout Iraq, and on into Iran. And one of the tells that he dug in for about two seasons was was Babylon. Now, it's too bad that he didn't get going, because the Germans came along later and excavated the whole thing. So most of the good stuff now is in the Berlin Museum. But nonetheless, Henry Layard did obtain a number of very useful things. One of the things that he took to the British Museum was a brick, a clay brick. And this brick has on the one side a stamp. And it is clearly a stamp, because you can see the edges, you can see where it was imprinted into the clay. And it can still be read. And the inscription reads, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, keeper of," and the names are of two temples which were built by Nebuchadnezzar, rebuilt by Nebuchadnezzar, "son of Nabopolassar, king of Babylon." Interestingly, the critics of the Bible had said only a few years earlier that there was no such thing as Nebuchadnezzar. All these people were myths and dreams. But there, quite clearly, and Bible students jumped on it right away, we have evidence of the existence of Nebuchadnezzar. And that's interesting, and certainly that's real. Because it does tell us that Nebuchadnezzar was a very vain individual. And we can see traces of that in Daniel's prophecy when we read it. It also tells us that Nebuchadnezzar was a very active individual. He built a lot. And there are many more than just this one brick which have been discovered from Babylon. So there are a number of questions arise. In this country, we're now going into a rapid-fire stimulus mode. And that stimulus is being injected into infrastructure, which means things like roads and hospitals and rapid transit systems and all that sort of thing. Well, Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing in Babylon. He built all over the place. So there are two or three questions that arise, don't it? Where our money is coming from deficit spending. We're borrowing the money. Where did Nebuchadnezzar get his money? And where did Nebuchadnezzar get all the hands to build the places that he was suddenly going to build? Well, the answer is in the chapter which we read. And interestingly, if you look on the side of the brick that we were talking about a minute ago, this Nebuchadnezzar's brick, and there's Nebuchadnezzar's stamp. But up above that, scratched probably with a piece of stick, there are three letters, Z, B, N. And these letters are in an Aramaic script. And these letters are for a name of someone who made the brick and who put his name on it, in addition to the stamp which Nebuchadnezzar insisted on having there. It was Zebina. How do we know this? Well, the Masoretes, many years later, sorted out the Jewish alphabet for us and put those little vowel points in. And this happens to be a Jewish name. Are we sure that it's a Jewish name? And the answer is yes. Because there were Jews who worked on those building projects. And there were other Jews who, when they got to Babylon, who actually became business people. And those business people kept records, meticulous records of the sales and the loans that they made and all of the other things. And in these lists of people that came to deal with those Jewish merchants, we find this Zebina more times than once, several times. We find him just listed that way. We also find it listed as the son of and as the father of. And they're different. So what we see here is that that name was fashionable, shall we say, among Jewish boys in the time when the Jewish people were taken by the Babylonians into Babylon. There's one more thing. In the 10th chapter of Ezra, near the end of the chapter, we meet this name again. And so we know that a Jewish fellow went back from Babylon, back into Israel, when they went with Ezra and Nehemiah. So that tells us yet again, almost certainly not the same individual, but that tells us yet again that this was a common enough name and a Jewish name, which was used at that time. So, on the back of the brick, we have evidence of a Jewish conscript who was working for his Babylonian masters. That was where the labor force came from for Nebuchadnezzar. Not just Jews. There were all sorts of nationalities. Where did the money come from? Well, the section that we read in Jeremiah doesn't make that quite so clear as some of the other sections. But if you read the chapter before that, you'll find that Nebuchadnezzar took all kinds of wealth back to Babylon with him. And that had happened throughout Asia Minor. That was where the money came from. So quite interestingly, in a little brick, which is now in the British Museum, we have confirmation of what the Bible says happened to the Jewish people under three separate invasions from the Babylonians through by Nebuchadnezzar. I'm going to go backwards. We've started now in pretty close to the year 600. Actually, the temple was destroyed in 586. And about 50 years after that, the Persian Empire Persian Empire occupied Babylon, and then another two or three years after that, the Jews started to come back to their homeland. So that's the time frame that we've been talking about so far. We're going to go backwards now, and we're going to go back into the Assyrian Empire. We're going to talk about Sennacherib. Sennacherib was an interesting individual because he was very, very militant. carried out a number of very significant campaigns throughout the Middle East. And yet, in the end of the 19th chapter of 2 Kings, we have these words in the last two verses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the house of Nisroch his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer his son smote him with a sword. And they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon his son reigned in his stead. What was going on? And what's the significance of this in terms of history and what is happening? Well, in a series of records known as the Babylonian Chronicles, because they were discovered in a library which was part of the Assyrian Empire at the time when these records were taken, but nonetheless filed in Babylon, we have a record which tells us that Sennacherib's sons, well, it doesn't say the names of the sons on this one, Esarhaddon does that, that Sennacherib was assassinated in an insurrection. It gives us the date, and it then says who succeeded him, and that was Esarhaddon, his son. Now, it happens when you go to the records that Esarhaddon left in his triumphal disc, and all of these kings wrote down the great things that they had done. It happens when you go there, we discover that Sennacherib decided that his eldest son, Esarhaddon was not the eldest, that his eldest son should not succeed him. And Sennacherib determined that the second son, Esarhaddon, should actually be the succeeding king. So, what was going on here? We go to another record. There are several of them throughout the Assyrian area. They come up in different libraries. And then there's mention in Josephus, and there's mentioned in another writer who made up a continuous history of the area in the year about 400 BC. In all of these, we have the same story, and each one of them adds a little more. We're told in another record that it was the sons of Sennacherib that assassinated him. So what's happening? Well, the eldest son was passed over. Second son was given the kingship. The third son joined with the first son in an effort to gain support and to take over his father's throne. So does the Bible tell the story accurately? Well, interestingly, when you look, we can't find the name of the third son in any of the records, but we can find the name of this first son. And his name doesn't quite look like this Adrammelech, which we have here in Kings. But if we do two things with this word, and one of them is presume that the scribes in the Hebrew tongue actually wrote down a Hebrew version of the name, that takes care of the first part of it. If we then assume that in the Hebrew tongue, the last syllable sounds better as we have it here than it did in the original, to the Hebrew that is, we then are using a word which means king at the end. So this is a double-barreled word in Assyrian. It means this man who was related to the king. It's his first name. His position is indicated by the second name. If we simply assume that some scribe decided that that shouldn't be a sound on the end, it should be different. So isn't it interesting that probably with a little minor slip of the pen or deliberate change of the pen, what we have is an accurate portrayal of what happened. The eldest son decided that he was not going to be passed over, gained a little help and a small group of them, and we know this from the other other records, took off into what is now present-day Armenia after they couldn't gain enough support because Esarhaddon must have been ahead of them. He must have assumed what was going on in the plot. This we're not told, but it seems to make sense. And he was there with his supporters to make sure that those who killed Sennacherib were sent away. Sennacherib is interesting because he certainly invaded Israel. He came down, it was in Sennacherib's day that the tunnel was built to bring spring water safely to Jerusalem. And there we have another inscription relating what happened in that day. And so the history of the Bible in this period fits together with the history that we see from other parts of the near Middle East. What the one says fills in a little detail that is missed out of the others. Now, many times over the years, people have said, well, there's absolutely no evidence for so-and-so in anywhere. And interestingly, after a lot of study, after a lot of research, after a lot of searching, there is still this considerable debate about whether Solomon exists. There's still no record, actually, of the name of Solomon outside the Bible. And until about 15 years ago, there was no record of the name David outside the Bible. But about 15 years ago, a piece of black basalt stone was discovered in northern Israel, in an area which today is called Tel Dan, and it was the city of Dan. And this is a copy of the inscription, what is called the Tel Dan inscription. Now, the significance of this particular piece is that it gives us a clear picture of what Hebrew writing looked like in those days, and that's one thing. But more than that, the story on the record says that the Syrian king, the king that came from an area near Syria, invaded. He came down and he killed the king of Israel and the king of Judah. And with respect to the king of Judah, it says quite clearly that this king was a son of the house of David. Now, when you look at the time period involved, and one of the kings was Ahaziah, king of Judah, one of those kings, when you look at the time period involved, we're looking at no more than about 100 years from the time when David lived. And the way that phrase is used throughout many, many texts in the Middle East, this phrase, the house of David, refers very clearly to a founding father and the dynasty which followed him. It places this securely within the land of Israel, within what we think of Israel today, the land of Judah in those days, and it places it once again firmly within a time frame which in the Bible tells us that there were these two kings killed. The interesting thing is that the Bible says that Jehu, who was a general in the Israeli army, killed these two men in an insurrection. But the Syrian king, and it's almost certainly Hazael at that time, he claims to have killed them himself. Now, the scholars say, well, this is a problem. The two stories are quite different. So what's going on? It doesn't bother me personally because I have worked with politicians in the course of my career, and I know very well that anybody who's in the top will take credit for something if it happens and he considers it to his favor. So it doesn't surprise me at all that the king that is determining that he won a great victory here would say that I caused the deaths of two kings in the land of Judea. And following that, then, we don't really have too much, but we can guess at what's some of the things which are in the rest of the stone that he then did very well out of this, you know, with things that they take home, as Nebuchadnezzar did, with the plunder and so forth, the tribute that they take. All of that goes home to Syria in this case, and all of that then belongs to somebody else. But until 20 years ago, David didn't exist outside the Bible. About 15 years ago now, this inscription was discovered. It was fairly easy to interpret. There had to be bits reconstructed in the text because of damage. But all of a sudden, we find that someone that seemed to be a bit of a myth, a bit of a hidden idea, is suddenly present and suddenly there and suddenly real. And suddenly the things that are in the Bible then begin to make sense. Interestingly, there's a little magazine. I don't know whether there are any left in the back, on the table at the back. But in 2005, there were excavations in Jerusalem. And a palace, which certainly dates back to around the time when David lived, was discovered. And so the archaeologists feel fairly confident that they are uncovering works which go back to the time of David, structures which were built by the rulers in Jerusalem at that time. And now that we know that David was the founder of the Jewish line of kings, it's almost certain then that it was David that built those buildings. It's interesting how things that people said couldn't be gradually come to be. In 1 Samuel, chapter 13, at the end of the chapter, in the authorized version, there's a horrible piece of translating. Doesn't make any sense at all. Didn't make any sense because until quite recently, nobody had any idea what the word meant. Maybe some of the newer translations, and there are a few in the room, have different phrases. But it's something which has really only come to light in the last 20 years or thereabouts. Starting at verse 19 in 1 Samuel 13, there was no smith in the land of Israel. This is the sort of protectionism that people are talking about nowadays. You know, you keep your trade secrets to yourself. And that way you protect the investment that you have and your own technology base. They didn't have the patenting license legislation or anything like that in those days. So the way that they kept their trade secrets was to make sure that nobody else found out about them. Lest the Hebrews make spears and swords, and this you see, to make things of iron, was a trade secret in those days. The Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen his tools. Yet they had a file for the mattocks, it says, is the phrase here. And in the margin of my Bible, it says a file with mouths. Phrase doesn't make any difference. And of course, they didn't have files in those days. What they had was bits of stone that they used to sharpen tools. So what did they take? What did they take with them? Because that's what the verse actually is indicating. They took their tools and they took something else to get it sharpened. Well, it happens that the word in the Hebrew is a pim. What was a pim? Well, eventually in the excavations throughout Israel, this item was discovered. It's a weight. So what's the significance of taking a weight? It wasn't actually the stone weight that was taken. It was the value that the weight represented. And when you make allowances for wear and tear on the little stone weight nowadays, it seems that the amount of money, and that's what we're talking about here, the amount of money that the Israelites had to take with them to get a tool sharpened was two-thirds of a shekel of silver. I don't know whether any of your More modern translations indicate that clearly, but that's what the phrase means. And you see, archaeology then fills in these funny little details. You just keep looking, and eventually all these words and phrases, words that really don't mean very much if you just take the straight, raw sense of what that word might mean. But once you have found an item which you can identify with a word, all of a sudden the whole text becomes evident. The Israelites had to pay for the service. It was expensive because the Philistines were determined to make money out of the deal as well as keeping the technology to themselves so that the Israelites would not be able to arm themselves with iron weapons and be a significant threat to them on the field of battle. There's quite a lot going on here. Quite a lot going on here. Well, when you keep going farther back in time, and this is very much an aspect of modern archaeology, the question of the Exodus. Did it happen? Did it happen? And there are all kinds of people who have looked at this issue very seriously and very, very hard for many years, who feel that the Exodus probably didn't happen. Well, is there any sort of external fit for what was going on there? And the answer is that if you date things back approximately, and we don't know exactly what the dates of the patriarchs were, if you sort of date things back approximately through time, you find that there were periods when Egypt's success came and went. They waxed and waned in power. There were times when they extended their influence out throughout the land of Canaan, and times when they went back and they were really enfeebled, and they had almost no military force at all to get beyond their immediate borders. And there are times when their borders were quite porous. We also find that there were times when they welcomed foreigners into their midst, and there are times when they built cities through what we now think of as the southern Negev to make sure that nobody got into Egypt unless they were allowed, unless they had the diplomatic passport, as we might say nowadays. What you find when you look at these waves and the probable times of the Exodus and the entrance into Egypt was that when Jacob took his family down there, and Joseph was in Egypt, that was a period when Egypt was welcoming to foreigners. We find then that the Egyptians went through a period of considerable severity after that towards foreigners, when they built forts along that northern border, and when it was almost impossible to get into Egypt, and that was the period when the Israelites were probably enslaved there. And that explains the attitude of the Egyptians to the Israelites when they were down there. And then when you look at the route that was taken when the Israelites came out, they came south of the line of Egyptian forts, went straight across the desert, and then came around from the north. So geographically and in terms of what was going on in Egyptian society, it makes sense to fit the two nations and their going and coming together within the space of about 1600 and onward BC. And then interestingly, we find a stele. It's called the Merenephta stele, and it's written on the back of one that was made by Amenopsis III. On the back of Amenopsis' stele then, he turned it over, and the next pharaoh wrote all the wonderful things that he had done. And Merenepta actually went on a raiding journey up through what we nowadays think of as the land of Israel, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and all through that territory, up as far north as Lebanon. out into what is modern-day Jordan. And all of these areas are mentioned. They're all mentioned by name on the stele. Said Merneptah, I went and I did this and I brought back all these treasures. I conquered that land belonging to those people, another land belonging to another set of people, and so forth. They're all listed. And then, interestingly, there's another little word. And that word everybody is certain of is the word Israel. It's not a land of Israel. It's the people. It's a group of people, significant in size to be a force to be reckoned with by this invading army from Egypt, but who weren't considered to be settled in the land. It's about 1250, the date of the stele. And when you think in terms of the probable time when Joshua took the Israelites back into the land, it's somewhere in that era. And the interval of Joshua and the Judges falls about that point in time. So isn't it interesting that when we read in the Bible of the conquests that Joshua made, when we read in the Bible of the stresses between these people who were resident in the land of Canaan and the Judges, and you see what was going on within the Israeli nation itself, they were gradually settling. They were not a fully settled people at that time. And so when we read in the Egyptian stele that there was a people there, significant, forceful enough to be reckoned with in terms of the Egyptian army, but not fully settled, it fits and fits very well with the record that we have within our Bibles. We think of Samuel as living in a very developed land, but if you look at the space, the journey that he took, it was really quite a small area. If you look at the cities that he went to, they didn't cover a very huge area. It wasn't until David that things started to develop. If you look gradually at this time period, what the archaeologists call Iron One, we find a gradual increase in settlements and then a sudden burst of activity. Settlements spring up all over the place, in and around the time of Samuel, leading on into the time of David. The record that we read and what's seen and what's written by independent observers fits together. I'm not going to look up every one of these, but I want to take you on a very quick cook's tour through Jeremiah. It's something that's been developing for the last 20 years in Israeli archaeology. The finding of the people that are mentioned in these chapters. It's one thing to talk about a king like Nebuchadnezzar. It's another thing to talk about, in general terms, whether there was a settled people, as we were saying in the times of Joshua, which probably coincide with the time of Merneptah, the Egyptian pharaoh. It's another thing, then, when you come down to a period here, which is referred to in Jeremiah, to find the people referred to in the archaeological record. These are the little guys. These are the ones that sat at their desks and wrote and looked after things and kept the world going, kept things alive for their nation. In the 32nd chapter, my hay fever is bothering me and my voice is starting to pack up. 32nd chapter, we won't look them up. We have Berechiah, the son of Neriah. In the most English Bibles, he's referred to as Baruch. the son of Neriah. And Baruch was the scribe that is credited with writing Jeremiah's prophecy on paper. Now, how do we know that he existed? Well, in the days that we're talking about, when these scrolls were first prepared, when the records were first made, the record, if it was on paper, would be folded up and sealed with a piece of leather tie, and then the leather tie would have a clay seal pressed onto the end of it, and in there you would write what the document was about, who wrote it, and any other pertinent information on that little seal. And that was the sort of library reference in those days. What happened, of course, was that these things, when they open the seal, you probably break it and lose it, and they get lost. But what happens occasionally is that along comes somebody like the Babylonians who burns the whole city down. And when that city was burnt to the ground, well, all these little clay discs were hardened, were fired, and they became like little bricks. And what was written on those clay discs then is still with us. And we find at least half of the people that are mentioned in Jeremiah on all those little discs, which were found in the administrative section of the city of David. So that's up towards the northern part of the hill. So in Jeremiah 32, they have a reference to Berechiah, the son of Neriah. In Jeremiah 36, we have a reference to Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, and his disc has been found. Jeremiah 37, we have Yehukal, the son of Shelemiah. His disc has been found. Jeremiah 38, we have Malchijah, the son of the king, and his disc has been found. Jeremiah 38, we have Gedaliah, the son of Pasha, and his disc has been found. In Jeremiah 40, we have Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, and his disc has been found. Now, in addition to that, we have two or three other Gedaliahs. Now, one of them is probably the same one with a different title. But there are two others. One of them is called the servant of the king, Gedaliah, the servant of the king. The other one is called Gedaliah, the high steward. And the scholars feel that it's this disc of the high steward, which was sealed by Gedaliah when he was operating on behalf of the Babylonian king. So, and then in Jeremiah 41, we have Elishama, the king's son. And we could go through Kings and Chronicles and find a similar list of names. In Ezekiel, there's somebody called Jezaniah, who confronted Ezekiel, who was present there in the temple. It's in Ezekiel 11. We have a Jezaniah, was the servant of a king, and his disc is there. It's surprising. Two things are here. One, the names were current. The names were all fashionable. Secondly, in many cases, the names of these people were associated with their family history. And thirdly, their names in many instances are associated with their activities as they were recorded in the records on those little discs, those little bulli, as they're called. Two last points. Firstly, many scholars feel that writing was not really part of the lives of most of the Jewish people. This little disc is in the showcase back there. Have a look. I'll put it back after the talk and you can have a look at it. It's a calendar. It's in a reasonably good hand, but not a particularly well-developed hand, technically, as far as the writing skill is concerned. Not only that, if you were able to see the original, you would realize that somebody had taken another stone and filed chunks of it out and inscribed again in the same place. In other words, it's very much, I don't know what you did when you were a kid, but when I was about 8 or 9 and sitting at a desk in England, learning my A's, B's and C's, we had slates and chalk and things for that initial stage. And so when you didn't get it right, you'd probably get straightened out by the teacher and you'd rub it out and do it again. That's what's going on here. But the other interesting thing is that it's a calendar. It's an agricultural calendar. It goes through the year, and it indicates what people did in their agricultural time frame as the year went on. And it dates to around 1000 BC. In other words, it's around the time of David, when there were still a lot of people living on the land, a lot of people wondering what they should do, whether they should plant today, tomorrow, or whatever. But it also indicates to us that literacy was developing in the Jewish nation. And literacy is important if you're going to keep your historical records together. There's an ostracon in the British Museum, and that's, you know, a piece of slate and you tile or whatever, and you write on the back of it, and it's a rather feeble attempt to go through the alphabet in early Hebrew letters. Somebody was learning to write their A's, B's, and C's on the back of a tile. That one dates to around 1200 BC. And then also, from around 1200 BC, we have a little silver scroll which was found in a tomb. And engraved on that scroll are the words of this great benediction coming from the law of Moses. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. Lord, make his face to shine upon thee and give thee peace. And it tells us then that words of Moses were current around 1200 BC. They were being written down by others. They were treasured and they were being laid to rest with people. And the last point, to go back to the reading that we took, the end of Jeremiah. In the 30th and 7th year of the captivity of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, in the 5th and 20th year, the king lifted the head of Jehoiakim, brought him out of prison, spake kindly to him, and changed his prison garbs, and gave him a portion for his diet for the remainder of his life. Babylonian library looks like it's like this. This is actually from Eblah. It's a Smithsonian Institute copy. It's got nothing. It's actually a recipe for what you do if you're bitten by a snake. But that's what the tablets look like that were found in the Babylonian library. And those tablets in the Babylonian library list all the stuff that went through the royal storehouse on a day by day by day by day basis. And for somebody that picked up this tablet and translated it and went on down, it was boring stuff until they finally came to the name Jehoiachin. And these tablets are now in the Berlin Museum. And what the tablet says was that Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, and his family, and some of them are named, was allowed a certain ration. Now, we don't have the master tablet, which determined that he should get this on a continuing basis. But what we do have are several of those routine tablets that says on this day, he got that, and on another day, he got something else. Again, it puts the man where the Bible says he was. It puts the man in a circumstance that the Bible says he was in. It puts the man in the conditions and receiving the treatment. The details are there right down to the last little bit. So, we had an interesting time with our Jewish guide of about 30 years ago. Because as I said, she really understood her Old Testament. She knew the detail in it. But to me, as I pointed out to her on a number of occasions, the fact that the Bible is a pretty good history book, considering that it's been in human hands for so long, that's been copied and recopied, and passages have been lost, and people have wondered, and people have gone into exile, and what happened to their texts then? I mean, just think about it. Think what it's gone through over the years. And yet it's still here, and we've still got in these documents personal names, personal details, all kinds of things like that. So if it's accurate, if it's reliable, maybe we should take it seriously.